Hello, hello. Welcome to Subaltern Speaks podcast, episode number 2. I'm your host, Yasamin Jame. For this episode, we have a very special guest for you, Dr. Victor Rivas, professor of Latin American Literary and Cultural Studies here at the University of Toronto, and associate chair of the Latin American Studies program at the Department of Spanish and Portuguese. In this episode, we will be discussing the syncretic spiritist cult of Maria Leonza in Venezuela. So without further ado, let's jump in and introduce to you Professor Rivas. How are you doing, Professor Rivas, today?
I'm doing well. Thank you, Yasemin.
Great. I guess the first place we can start this interview is, could you tell us a little bit about yourself, what you do?
Sure. I'm an assistant professor of Latin American culture and literatures, a contemporary, that means the 20th century, 21st century. I look at literatures of what we call resistance, which are typically narratives that are counter to the status quo. A quick example would be guerrilla writing, which are typically people who have participated in the guerrilla warfares in Latin America, Central America, for example, in South America. And in my particular case, I'm looking at the writers from Venezuela who have both participated in the Venezuelan guerrilla warfares of the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and also in Central America. Some of them even joined the Sandinista revolution. Resistance writing also has to do with indigenous narratives that go counter to the status quo, again, what we call the official histories of any nation. And these narratives that I look at then provided an alternative view of a perception of history, a perception of even realities. And a case in point might be the testimonies of Rigoberta Menchú Tum from Guatemala. She did win a Nobel Peace Prize for her writing, her narrative writing, recounting her experiences as a Maya indigenous woman going through a wartime period in Guatemala and bringing her story then to the world at large. It is this narrative that then earned her the Peace Prize, because knowledge of these narratives became part of a world effort to ask the Guatemalan government to basically to start peace talks. So these are the type of narratives that I work with in general terms.
Well, that just goes right into the whole theme of this podcast, which is just challenging these like narratives that we're so used to, you know, history with the capital H, the official histories, because and history also, it bleeds into culture and into religion. So we also would like to challenge, you know, how people practice their spiritualities, especially in the colonized, and especially in the places that have been colonized, and how they still try to maintain their culture even when they faced oppression from their colonizers, and how they try to resist in very subtle ways oftentimes. So that leads on to our topic of today, which is Maria Leonza. So when I first approached you, you were very quick to recommend this topic. I had no idea who she was, that this practice even existed. But you were pretty quick to recommend it. So I just wanted to know, why did you think this topic was so suitable? And if you could go a little bit into who she is and why she's so significant.
Sure. So part of what I was saying a moment ago about the type of writings that I work with, resistance literatures, resistance narratives, the one particular testimonial that I was working with in Venezuela, written by a guerrilla fighter named Ali Gomez Garcia, he had actually won a literary prize, a quite high-ranking literary prize, very, very important literary prize, from the Casa de las Américas in Cuba. It was to honor the type of narratives called testimonio, which are particular to Latin America. Even though testimonios are now recognized as world literatures, they're practiced in different parts of the world, at that time when this prize was given in the mid-80s, the Cuban government and then Latin American intellectuals were trying to establish testimonio as a literary genre. What is particular about this testimonio is that, first to understand it, is that testimonios have to be characterized as usually first-person narratives, people who have lived through an experience and that they're able to talk about it. And their main characteristic is that they are true. They are verifiable. They are factual. And then also they're urgent. They're meant to be dispersed and shared with the population at large in order to bring that consciousness of a political situation to the rest of the world. Again, to exert the communities at large that are involved in these type of conflicts to find a resolution, peaceful. What distinguished this particular testimonial of this guerrilla fighter is that not only did he write about his own accounts, his own life story, but he also incorporated history that is going back to the movements of independence in Latin America, in particular Simón Bolívar. And Simón Bolívar, as a historical figure, is a character that he incorporates in his narrative. So now he's already subverting the genre itself, as it was being established in the 70s and in the 80s, by incorporating a historical figure that is actually dialoguing with him, the person who's writing the narrative, as if he were a contemporary of a guerrilla fighter that lived in the 80s and in the 70s. So not only does he incorporate a historical figure from the Venezuelan and from Latin American official history, but then he goes on to incorporate two more characters, one from legend, just popular culture, that represents the Afro-Venezuelan communities. Her name is Mama Inés. She's not a real character, but she is more of a compound character, a synthesis, if you wish, of many different African, Venezuelan, African, Latin American people, some real, some legendary, some even mythical. So Mama Inés is a character that he also has a one-on-one dialogue in his narrative inside the testimonial. To add to that, he has another character, a female character, who represents the indigenous populations. And this character, coming from indigenous myths, is Maria Leonza. Maria Leonza then is a considered for the general terms, for general purposes, Maria Leonza is considered an indigenous character who represents a part of an indigenous myth that has survived since before the times of the conquest in Latin America, in particular to the area of Venezuela. Maria Leonza has several different iterations in terms of her origins. Maria Leonza is said in one story to be the daughter of a cacique, a leader of a particular group or tribe in the northwest part of Venezuela. The story, according to that iteration or that version, that stays close to the indigenous myth, is that her name was Yara, that's Y-A-R-A, and that she was the daughter of the cacique, the leader, and for one reason or another, these are always variations, she is threatened, and the father sends her away to go live near a mountain called Sorte, S-O-R-T-E, in the current state of Yaracuy in Venezuela today. Part of the legend, or the myth, rather, says that she is looking into a lake, a deep lake, and an anaconda, a giant snake, comes out of the water and devours her. And while she's inside of the snake, she appeals to the spirits of the mountain of Sorte, where she was sent to by her father, to please release her unharmed. Apparently, the spirits of the mountain respond, and they cause the giant snake, the anaconda, to swell up and burst, thus liberating Maria, or rather, Yara, in this case, Yara, before she becomes Maria. And then Yara is going to be assimilated by the mountain and becomes the spirit, the queen, rather, of all the spirits of nature. So this is the indigenous aspect of the legend, but it has other aspects too.
Right. So we can jump into that as we go forward. So that's her backstory. She was, her indigenous name is Yara, and I assume she became Maria Leonza later after the colonization by the Spanish. But before we jump into that, I kind of wanted to talk about, we already set the stage of her myth. I wanted to know, is there a point in history where, like, historians or anthropologists can pinpoint to where her worship began?
Yeah, it's a bit of a complex story, but the what we're calling now the myth, or if you wish, now the today it's called a cult, and that has different explanations. But the myth of Maria Leonza, the legend, if you wish, has existed since colonial times. So colonial times, we're talking about the 16th century, 17th century, all the way up to now, to the present. It becomes prominent towards the end of the 19th century, especially in the beginning of the 20th century, when people are talking about the story. People are going in pilgrimages to the area of Sorte in the state of Yaracuy, and different anthropologists, in particular Angelina Pollock Eltz, and another anthropologist also, Daisy Barreto, both of them have studied extensively the myth and the cult of Maria Leonza. And Angelina Pollock Eltz states in the 70s, that in the early 70s, that the cult of Maria Leonza, as we understand it today, moved from the remote states of Yaracuy, which was a rural area, to the capital, to the urban areas of Venezuela, due to the advent of the oil industry. So oil exploration and then oil exploitation and the settling of oil camps and oil centers, and then the administrative centers in the capital, for example, in Caracas, or the other regional big cities like Maracaibo or Valencia, one's in the east of the country, the other one's in the center. So these big centers would be the place where the oil workers, their families, anybody working in the oil industry would move to from the rural areas, and they would bring with them the story of Maria Leonza. In the 1950s, it occurs that the dictatorship of Marcos Pérez Jiménez actually incorporates, or if you wish, sanctions by their actions, the cult of Maria Leonza already present in the urban setting of the capital of Caracas, to the effect that in 1950-51, a very famous architect named Alejandro Colina is commissioned to create a statue of Maria Leonza that was supposed to adorn the entrance to the university, the Central University of Venezuela, Universidad Central de Venezuela. So the statue, it was larger than life, larger than, right, you stand to it, it's almost a real person and a half, quite a large statue. It is quite famous. There are multiple images and reproductions of different sizes. You have postcards of this particular monument that I'm talking about. This is one that was cast, and the original version was set at the entrance, one of the main entrances to the Universidad Central de Venezuela, downtown Caracas, by the way, which is itself now declared a UNESCO World Heritage Site. So that statue could be there, but then they moved it because there were too many too many interventions of devotees to the cult, to the religion, coming to the foot of the statue and performing their ceremonies and their rites to the statue, interrupting a bit of the flow. Also, there was most likely some idea within the government that even though they had sanctioned this, that maybe there was too much disruption and maybe a little bit of fear that perhaps the populace would move more towards that belief system than the official Catholic of the nation. The statue then was moved in between the highways in the east side of Caracas in the capital. So now it's there. There are a couple of copies of that statue. The statue represents an indigenous woman who is not wearing any clothing, and she's holding up above her head, two arms outstretched above her head, a large basket, would look to be a basket, a flat basket, full of the fruits and vegetables that would be native to of course, to Venezuela. And then she's mounted, she's riding a giant tapir. We call it Danta in Venezuela, but a giant tapir. And that's the iconic representation of Maria Leonza as represented by the statue of Alejandro Colina. But she has many different other representations, which we can talk about in just a moment.
So I personally, when I was researching, I saw different depictions of her. I've seen her with more European clothes, more biblical clothes with the robes. So not as she's represented in the statue, basically nude. I've seen her with green eyes. Her green eyes are very striking in almost all the portraits. And then I've seen other portraits where she's more in indigenous clothes and more what stereotypical Indian clothes.
All right.
So I was wondering why all these different depictions. Is it because there has been an attempt to whitewash her, perhaps? They tried to make her look some sort of Cinderella, some sort of European princess? Or is it just because there's so many different versions of the story? Because when I was reading, I heard there's some stories that say she wasn't actually indigenous, she was a mestiza. I don't know if that's to what extent that is true. But anyway, that just goes to say there's a lot of things that people are saying throughout the years. And it's just a complex situation. So I wanted to ask you about that and see how much of it is just because of differing accounts or how much of it is due to maybe whitewashing, due to the colonization. They have to make her look more European, more like the Virgin Mary, in order to bring it in line with the Catholic
right.
Church.
Well, to answer that, you're right, Yasmin. It is a very complex narrative, very complex story. Maria Leonza, as we said at the onset, is represented through many different narratives, many different versions. Again, what we said at the beginning is that her original representation has to do with an indigenous maiden, I guess to use this word, a princess, of course. She's the daughter of the cacique. And we find her in that situation with the anaconda. That's how she becomes the queen of the mountain. That's how she becomes the leader of the animals, the ruler of the flora and the fauna of the area. So she becomes important as a deity, a goddess, if you wish, that is important, if we understand it, to indigenous beliefs in the area when they're trying to relate to nature. So she's considered a goddess of nature. With the conquest and with colonization, of course, you get the introduction of the Spanish, in particular, this region of Venezuela. And the story of Maria Leonza then becomes syncretized. So when we talk about this religion or cult, it depends on the point of view, it is referred to and explained as a syncretized religion or cult. Because, in fact, it does bring in elements of not only the indigenous myth, but it also brings in elements of Christianity, in particular Catholicism, brought in by the Spanish conquistadores and colonizers of the area. And then eventually it brings in elements of the Afro-Venezuelan, to use the term today, the people who were brought in by the Europeans for the slave trade. They brought in elements of their own cultures, mostly from Western Africa. So these three cultures, these three groups, contribute now to the current understanding and the current iteration or version of Maria Leonza today. It also explains the name and the question you were asking, Yasmin, about the representation of Maria Leonza. If at first during the indigenous recountings of the myth or the legend, she's the indigenous daughter, she will be represented as an indigenous woman. When Alejandro Colina in the mid-20th century represents her, he is trying to be faithful to that notion of representation, because the Venezuelan government in the mid-20th century, like many other governments in Latin America, are trying hard to recover and be proud of an indigenous past. So not to minimize the European legacy, but to say, hey, here we are, we do have an indigenous past, let's recognize that. So that's in the mid-50s of the 20th century. When the Spanish come into contact with the indigenous population, they will start modifying the story. Here's where the name of Yara changes. Yara now is going to be represented in stories that vary from that of the lake or the river where she's swallowed up by an anaconda to have been maybe a mestiza. Mestiza would have been the child of a European person and an indigenous person. So here she is, a mestiza now, represented with perhaps a darker skin, a bronzed skin perhaps, but also her eyes were either green or blue, typically green, and possibly even blondish hair. So this is the mestiza representation of her. And it will tag on to the story of the indigenous princess that was swallowed up by the anaconda, and then she's liberated by asking the mountain spirit to help her. And so all of that will be incorporated into the story of the mestiza. Another story says that she was indeed Spanish. She came over in one of the ships in the 1700s, and she was a name, Maria Isabel, and she has a very lofty name. But also the question of her name is part of that legend. Perhaps it is an attempt to not only syncretize, but also to accommodate what would be a deity, a goddess, that would be appealing to a changing population. If at the beginning it is indigenous, as the decades and the centuries come along, the identity will probably switch to mestiza. At one point she becomes quite European, quite Spanish. And then as the cultural mores and the cultural expectations change, she will go back to being mestiza and then indigenous. That's what happened in the mid-20th century. Now she's more indigenous than she was. Yet, what you see today are for example, paintings or cards, little wallet-sized cards that show her image as a very European-looking woman, long blonde hair, wearing a crown in a very European fashion, green eyes, very, very prominent. Yes, but you'll also see the indigenous representations too, which are more coming back into favor.
Yeah, yes, for sure. That we're going to talk about it more later on when we talk about the politics of the, basically, in a way, the politicization of Maria Leonza. Well, that's very interesting how you said that her representation changed, is sort of how the demographic of Venezuela changed over the times. Obviously, before Europeans, it was indigenous, like the native tribes and then and peoples. And then, of course, the Europeans came and the European admixture was introduced to Venezuela. And then she became more European. I don't know how, maybe perhaps I know like Venezuela had a lot of European immigration in like the early 20th century. Maybe that perhaps, I don't know, that might have influenced. So, that's very interesting how Maria Leonza kind of represents Venezuelans as a whole. And when I see her, when I was researching, of course, I see her, like her shrines and how, like pictures of her, she's alongside her are two other figures. One is a Black person, African person, and another one is an indigenous, you know, warrior with his spears and everything. So I was wondering who are these people and why are they so significant? I mean, I personally found it very curious how like all the three races were included somehow in this like trinity, the three races that basically make up the Hispanic culture as a whole, the African, the indigenous mestiza European, and of course the pure the indigenous warrior. So yeah, just if you could go a little bit into that, about what those three figures represent.
Right. Well, as we said before, the cult or the religion of Maria Leonza, it is considered syncretic. And as we explained earlier, syncretism in this case is the confluence of different religious beliefs, some that might be more dominant over the other. And so you do have elements of Catholicism, of Christianity, the whole pantheon of saints. You also have elements that came in from the indigenous beliefs. And then you also have the incorporation during the colonial times of the African beliefs, those that came from mostly the western part of Africa, as we said earlier. In the case of the African beliefs, they brought in also a belief system that was pantheistic, that is multiple gods, very much like the expression of Santeria in the Caribbean, particular Cuba. You would see that the African gods, in particular from the Yoruba people, would be the gods that could be represented as well by the Catholic saints, that pantheon of Catholic saints, calling out loud the name of the Catholic saints, Santa Barbara, for example, right, to then express the powers of the gods that were part of that Yoruba pantheon. In the case of Maria Leonza, she incorporates elements that would be related to Santeria, most particular in the way in which the different African deities will also be represented by the saints in the Catholic religion. So going back to your question, the image that you are referring to, Yasemin, where you see the bust of Maria Leonza, and then on either side of her, you'll see, for example, the bust of a Black person, in this case, his name is El Negro Felipe. Negro Felipe is supposed to represent, obviously, the African element of the population. And Guacaipuro, el cacique Guacaipuro, would represent the indigenous. So right there in that trilogy, you have represented the background of what would be the entirety or the makeup of, in particular, the Venezuelan population, but also representative of Latin American populations as a whole. What is missing, obviously, is the Asian element, right? It's the Asian contribution. But this is an older representation coming again from colonial times. And these were the three main groups, if you want to use racial distinctions, if you wish to use racial distinctions, this is the stereotype. Negro Felipe will be representing a synthesis of so many real and legendary characters, coming out of Venezuelan society, Afro-Venezuelan society in particular. And Guaycaipuro is perhaps the best known cacique or leader of his own group of indigenous people, his own tribe. These two people are going to be represented there with Maria Leonza. They will be known as the Tres Potencias, or the Three Powers. And they're there because both El Negro Felipe, as he's called in Spanish, and El Cacique Guaycaipuro were themselves, at least in the history, the way that we recall their narratives, they were themselves leaders of resistance against the colony, against the Spanish. So there are stories of Guaycaipuro, there are stories of so many other indigenous leaders who did fight with as strong as they could, right? So they did fight for many decades the advent of the not only conquistadores came exploring, but also the people who came after them to try and colonize the areas. Negro Felipe would have been, again, a synthesis of that same kind of resistance that people are trying to remember and incorporate into the official histories, beginning in the 19th century, especially after the Wars of Independence.
Yeah, how do these Venezuelans, these individuals, how do they reconcile that with their belief, with their Catholicism? Because like in a lot of interviews that they do, like journalists or whoever, historians go and ask the participants, they say, oh, well, do you believe in like Jesus? Do you believe in Catholicism? And they say, yes, of course, like God is first. Like, and then like Maria Leonza is the second thing we believe in. So how do they reconcile being Maria Leonceros and also being like good Catholics, basically?
It's a great question. It's a great question. It's the central question of so many research projects. The idea of reconciliation has to do with the belief system. As we talked about earlier, the cult or religion of Maria Leonza incorporates the idea of courts, and in each court, you might even have a court that's called the Celestial Court. And it is in this Celestial Court that we have all the different characters that would normally comprise the Catholic, and if you wish, the particularly the Christian saints, headed by the Virgin Mary, headed by Jesus Christ, headed by different characters that are biblical, right? But so in particular to Catholicism. And so they have an accommodation. There is an accommodation within this religion that will not exclude, so they're not rejecting the Catholic, the Christians, the larger Christian elements, and the belief system that is so important for Venezuelans. Venezuela is officially a Catholic nation. You look it up and the official religion will be Catholicism. But the cult of Maria Leonza, because of its syncretic characteristic, allows, as a matter of fact, one of the first aspects that must be considered is that a person has to believe in Christianity, has to believe in the elements of Christianity. So you have to believe in a God, you have to believe in perhaps the idea of the Trinity, you have to believe in Jesus Christ. And all of these are not incongruent. That is, they're not incompatible to an accommodated religion. So this concept of accommodation is important because it is one that is not meant to reject, as we said a moment ago, but is meant to incorporate, to allow for the different belief systems to come in. Earlier we said that there are elements, a lot of elements, of the Yoruba peoples. There are elements of the practices of Santeria and the system of Santeria that are reflected through these courts. There are elements of Spiritism, right? Of Kardec's contribution to this. And So we have spiritism, we have, again, the complexity of African cultural beliefs, religious beliefs. Then you have what is believed to be the original mythic element of the indigenous cultures.
Thank you for listening to the second episode of Subaltern Speaks. Your support is invaluable to us. The next upcoming episode will be part two of my interview with Professor Rivas, where we will discuss Maria Leonza's influence in shaping Venezuela's post-colonial, national, and spiritual identity in the 20th century, as well as how studying her cult can serve as an important segue to approaching the role of colonization on the spiritualities of subaltern peoples in a more critical manner.